Let me talk you through the two most emotional, stressful months of my sales career.
It's no big deal to call a CTO and tell I want to talk.
You cannot stand on the sideline and basically wait until the dice rolls itself. It's never gonna happen.
I don't know if this is gonna be on the record or off the record. It's almost like playing with cards, this job. Like, it's like you get given a hand of cards and like you have to do the best with what you have.
Someone might have been watching down on me.
Me and Jack going into this, when he originally told me exactly the same, like, oh, you know, Jack, I've got this idea, you know, what about this? My first thought was, my God, I don't even care if anyone, like, listens to this, you know. If I take one key takeaway from every recording, I'll be such a better rep.
This is No Big Deal, a sales podcast.
Welcome back to No Big Deal, where we are so excited to welcome Megan Huberty. Megan has hit 5 President's Clubs in a total of 7 years in sales. And at Concur in 2020, she won AE of the Year, selling the most ARR and units and generating the most net new pipeline. Megan has also been promoted in 3 times in 4 years. That's pretty good going, Megan. Personally, she's seen some impressive milestones. She paid off all of her college debt by 27, purchased and fully gutted and renovated her home in 2 years' time. And in her spare time, she prioritizes travel, taking multiple trips a year to experience new things in other countries and states across the US. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Welcome, Megan. Just to kick us off, we're going to jump into the deal in a minute. But what I want to know from you is, what did you do in particular on this deal that made it so sort of like memorable and such a big learning experience? And importantly, what did you do that only you really could have done on this deal? Like, what was your major skill that you kind of pulled out the bag on this deal that makes it so memorable?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing for me, and I know this is kind of cliche to say in sales, but I was just myself. I think that the biggest thing is bringing yourself to the table every single day as who you are in your personal life and your sales life. Is really what changes the game for people and shows that you are a real person. They're getting a real person, not a robot, not a salesperson. And you really care about their business. I think that was something that really set me apart and helped me grow through this entire experience. Just as a senior salesperson moving forward into a new role and getting more comfortable with who I am and how I can sell.
Amazing. And tell us, what made this deal the one that's the most memorable or the one that's the most impactful on your career that you wanted to talk about?
I had actually just transferred into a new space. So I went from being in just a mid-market space, which was less than 500 employees, to our national space, which was really interesting, challenged me in a lot of new ways to really figure out how companies are doing business, why they're doing business, and what's important to them. So I just think overall, learning a new space and applying those skills, falling down and skidding my knees a couple times, but being able to get back up and ultimately see the win at the end was really memorable for me.
And I'm just thinking, you've hit President's Club 5 years out of 7, promoted, you got AE of the Year, 3 promotions in 4 years. Did this deal, was it in the thick of all that? Is it like, was it a catalyst for some of that? Like, how did it help with the trajectory along all of those achievements?
Yeah, it actually closed in January. So we work a calendar year at SAP Concur. So it absolutely started my year off on the right foot. It's one of my largest size deals that I've closed for sure. So it was a huge feather in my cap to bring my confidence to help me continue to hit those milestones with my career and really prove, you know, why I was being promoted and why I deserved another President's Club.
Do you know what? I've got a quick question. People like you who achieve consistently time and time again, like not just 1 year, but 5 years in a row, 6 years in a row, 7 years in a row. What do you do at the end of each year that's like, I'm going for it again? Is it like you have like a reset? Is that like, do you have someone you're really angry at? So like, do you have something in your mind that keeps you going again and again?
Yeah, honestly, I'm ultra competitive. I'm super, super competitive. It's funny. My parents always wonder where that competitive spark came from because I was an athlete growing up. I'm 5'10". People always assume I like was really talented in the sports realm. I'm not. I trip over my own 2 feet, like walking down the sidewalk. But I found something that I really, really loved and sparked a fire in me. And so watching my name on the leaderboard and being able to challenge myself was what, you know, I honestly, watching the paychecks didn't suck either, but every year was a new milestone I wanted to hit. So this was the salary I wanted to bring in. This was the commission I wanted to see. And I never wanted to see that drop. And so challenging yourself in those ways, I guess I'm just hyper competitive. I think I really think that that's what challenged me. But being able to set an example for my peers too, and being able to help them hit those milestones too was really exciting for me. I think in order to be able to consistently be seen as someone to trust, you really have to set the bar for yourself and make sure you're doing it yourself too.
I think it's like a really classic characteristic of the top salespeople at each company. They're like not happy with anything less than being number one. And actually, I think I can hold my hands up here and said, like, there is a lot of jealousy that comes from me being in the office and seeing other people close big deals. I'm like, God damn it, I wish that was mine. Do you know what I mean? Like, there is that, but that should drive you. And I get that as well. Like, every year you have that feeling when your number goes back to zero and you're like, how am I going to motivate myself to go again?
Yeah. I had it just now. Like, the quarter ended and it was so intense and I was going for it so hard. And the quarter ended, it was like, oh, when this quarter's over, I'm going to take a few days to rest and relax. And the quarter's over, I'm like, right then, next quarter. I've got to go again. And everyone's like, it's the first week, man, relax.
I think we all feel that way, though. It's like you ride this high from a big win and your confidence is like so big that you feel like you can just tackle whatever beast you have kind of been avoiding in the background. And honestly, I think that's the best way to continue being better at your business. Like, fuel yourself with a confidence that you are a winner and you have been winning, to be able to take, you know, call that C-level executive who scares you, or call that company who you think would never purchase from you, right? When you're riding a high, confidence sells itself. So why not? I mean, it's the best time to sell.
Joey, you said something there, Megan, I just wanted to pick up on. You said like how you deal with your business. You said like how you're dealing with your business. After all that success you've had, have you ever considered running your own business, doing this on your own instead of working for someone else?
I really like personal freedom. I have zero desire to be in leadership, quite frankly. I love being able to lead without a title. I think I'm a little bit too much of a control freak from the aspect of I really like my business. I want to run my business. I'm responsible for my number, my business. I find a lot of joy from being able to help my peers hit milestones as well. But yeah, I don't really have any desire to want to do that for myself. I think that's a very specific personality that I'm going to leave those people who do it really well to do that.
Yeah, me too. I agree with that. I know, and it resonates with me because I'm exactly the same. I like being where I am. I'm autonomous. People work for us, but they don't really work for us. And it makes life easy. Okay, cool. Well, thanks so much for the intro. It's all the same to you, Jack. Should we jump into the deal?
Yeah, let's do it.
Yeah, Megan, tell us how it kicked off. Where did it start? What was the inception of the deal? How did it come from? Where did it come from? How did it originate?
Yeah, so like I said, I just started in this new space. So I was getting really excited to target larger companies. As we all know, larger companies typically come with larger deal size, which means more money in our pocket. So I was on it. I was excited to start hunting. And I had saw a company that had signed with Concur and unfortunately had canceled a couple years prior. So I wanted to dive into that, see what was the root cause of it. And really find some new folks to speak to there on really where their business was headed. It was a cement company, so I knew that they were growing. It was coming out of COVID, so there was a lot going on in that industry at the time. So I found out they had a new CFO, and I added my Megan Flair to it. I didn't just email him. I didn't just pick up the phone and call him. I wrote a handwritten card. It's something that I do for all senior level executives. I think it's really important to show that personal touch is there, and it got a response from him because it was so unique in that aspect. So he was excited. He was actually a former Concur user. So word of mouth goes a long way. I think he was able to kind of speak for us internally as well. So got my foot in the door that way. And then, you know, just continue to navigate through the hiccups of what was going to go on there.
What's your tactical advice for, it's just like perfect, and I should be doing it way more for my top accounts now. I'm also selling to probably a similar size company. What's your tactical advice for what you write in those handwritten messages, sending them to C-level executives?
It's incredibly simple. I don't make an ask. I just say, hey, congratulations on your new job. That's so incredibly exciting. You know, I look forward to connecting with you sometime throughout the next year. You know, and sometimes I'll add like a $5 coffee gift card or something and say, you know, in the meantime, enjoy celebratory coffee on me. So just showing them, hey, I see you, I hear you, congrats. We all love getting mail that's not a bill. Even when my grandma sends me my birthday cards, I get really excited and I'm in my 30s. So I think it just, it shows that, you know, as a partner, I'm willing to go above and beyond and think outside the box.
Smart. Very, very smart. Do you know what? There's a general theme here that most of the big deals that have an inception that were like self-generated often come from a really creative outbound approach, very like personalized, quite touching way to get in touch with it. And also it's always to the top. And then I'm assuming from there, Megan, you got introduced to somebody underneath the CFO who was leading this initiative.
I think as well, just to interject, how easy would it have been for Megan to see that this CFO had bought Concur before and be like, I'm just going to send them an email?
Yeah, so true.
Yeah.
It's gone like that extra mile.
I mean, and they're used to a certain level of care when they're with Concur too, right? I mean, I think it goes to show that just because you left that company doesn't mean you're not going to get that care with your new company. So continuing what they already know and love about a product and a company, I think was, you know, kind of top of mind for there. But yeah, he actually introduced me to his controller, who was decently new as well within the last year. So I was still kind of getting the ropes on things. They had a pre-existing platform in place that was a competitor of ours, who just wasn't fitting the bill anymore. They weren't able to expand with them globally, and that's really what they needed. And with, you know, expanding globally, there's a whole lot of complexities that come with that. So moving from being, you know, headquartered in America to operating in other countries, I mean, I'm sure we've all felt that in our seats, right, of having to figure out how are people doing business other places in the world and how is that going to affect how they're using our tools. So being able to really show up for them and prove to them what we can do for their business in that space was really important for that controller because they were having a lot of challenges around things like that.
And then from there, often we hear at this point, there's a bit of a spark, like a eureka moment where you're like, I'm in the deal here. And you have that moment of faith where you start to convince yourself there's a chance that this deal could start to happen. Did that happen for you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I had already talked to two people who were like, on board. So I'm over here like, oh, this deal's won. Like, this is simple. I have a former Concur user. Like, I have this controller who's super jazzed up about what I can do to fix his pain points. And then we started to bleed further into the org. And as I said, they were a former customer of ours and had canceled for a reason. Unfortunately, it was a negative reason. So when I started to meet folks who had been there for a little bit more of a tenure and had experienced that pain with the product prior to, that's where I really had to dive deep into where did that pain come from? Was it pre-existing pain that was not solved and it was not implemented correctly? Or was it caused by the product? And again, their business was in such a different state that it was something where I needed to kind of re-level set them and say, okay, well, that was kind of pains of 3 to 5 years ago. Where are we today? And how are we going to implement this correctly this time to fix those areas? So once I started getting on board, I think I had my first callers, like 6 of them on the call, 7 of them on the call from all different areas of the business, right? IT, I started getting deeper into the finance space, so actually bringing on the accounting team, I had the procurement team on there, and then I had HR on there as well.
Did you actively go and find all those people to bring them into the conversation? Did they naturally come together because this was an initiative? How did you get such a big group of people together?
Yeah, so that was naturally what came together. So it was for our discovery call, our scoping call to really figure out where the business was today and what we needed to bring to the table in order for this to work for them. So during that scoping call, I was really able to vet out, you know, the nuances, but also, you know, why do you have a sour taste in your mouth now? And then what do I need to do to flip that around? I think the biggest thing is just I had to listen. I had to listen a lot. And I think we get frustrated when people see our tool in a different light that we know isn't true, or we know isn't factual, right? Maybe it was implemented wrong, or maybe there was just certain things not turned on. You know, when you have such an incredibly customizable tool and certain things just aren't activated, it can come across as just not being able to do it or the functionality is not there. So how do you build, you know, go up that uphill battle. So that first call was literally just like, everybody throw up on me. What do you hate? What do we need to fix? And how do we, you know, take it to the next step from there?
How did you convince them, Megan, when they had a live project to not go with one of your competitors, given that they had a sour taste around?
Yeah, I think this is, you know, transparently something that our product just had the advantage. I mean, we're the number one global provider in this space. And so being able to prove that value with a growing company was super important. So looking at those intangibles and, you know, being able to replicate them, you know, basically pre-sale of what they're going to emulate post-sale, or I'm going to emulate post-sale, and showing them, you know, we can change this environment as what it was today. But quite frankly, you know, it's one of those things where we have that positive from a global perspective. So I think that really helped. And in that size and space, when you're growing that rapidly, you really need a tool who has proven success being able to customize very quickly with you.
And interestingly, well, I'm going through this situation at the moment. Did you do anything in particular, or do you do anything out of, like, any, in any of your habits in particular when bringing a group of people like that together? Do you do anything in, like, individually with them before meetings, after meetings? Do you have any trademarks along those lines that make those meetings go particularly well, that allow you to sit there and listen and soak up all the information without giving away, you know, your own frustrations and so on? Is there anything that you do there, any actionable advice that you could give people who are going into meetings at that size where there's perhaps going to be a bit of conflict?
Yes. So I start every meeting, especially if I'm in person, I start every meeting with a fun fact about me, one or two fun facts about me. And I say, hey guys, I know it's going to be painful, and I hated when people did this in school, but I'm going to need at least one fun fact about you as well.
No way. You asked them for a fun fact about
them.
So
like, I start off by introducing myself and telling them two fun facts. Typically it's that I live in Minnesota, because everyone thinks Minnesota is just like hell on earth, which usually it is. We had a mild winter, thank God. But and then I kickbox. And so it sort of stems these, you know, it makes me a real person. It makes me not just like Megan from Concur. It's like, oh, Megan has a life, right? And so then I ask them, like, hey, share a fun fact. And typically it's like, oh, I have a dog, or I have two kids, or, you know, yeah, I run marathons. Yeah. Like, it's
CFO.
Yeah, it's typically like something pretty generic. But a lot of, like, I've had people say some crazy stuff that, like, it sparked 15 minutes of conversation before. And so when you're planting these seeds of like, hey, you're a person, I'm a person, business sucks to talk about, personal life's way cooler, let's open the door and like spend more time on that. And then, you know, the business stuff will sort itself out, in my opinion, right? When you gain that level of trust with people, you're able to have really hard conversations on the back end because they trust you, right? You're becoming an advisor and not a salesperson anymore. And so having them get to know you is my first priority. I want them to know who Megan is, not who Megan from Concur is.
Jack, I would absolutely love to see you try and do that.
Do you know, I think I can pull that off.
Why not?
I think I would struggle.
I don't know. I don't think I'd be able to. Maybe it's because of our British awkwardness.
Yeah. Love to ask like a big CFO, big company. I think, do you know what? You can imagine scenarios where it would really work.
Yeah, 100%.
Like that, I 100% can imagine that.
And you're going to bring certain people with like personalities out of their sort of like corporate facade, and you're going to bring them into the
right world. Well, and it's cool too, because like a lot of these people don't interact on a very often basis, right? So like when I have four different departments together and they're like, oh, what, Susie, you just ran a marathon last summer, like that's crazy, what are you guys, you know, like it kind of like sparks them to get to know each other a little bit better too. It's cool to watch. I honestly, it is my favorite thing to do when I start meetings.
Smart. Okay. So keep going. Tell us what any other tactical advice about orchestrating or choreographing these big meetings, because you're going to have people on your side as well, people on their side. How do you make them before, during, and after run smoothly? Because this is like the crux and the success and failure of it.
So before, I definitely make sure to research who's going to be on that call, right? How long have they been at that company? I think tenure really shows how open they are to change a lot of times. So, you know, are they going to be the stickler in the mud? Are they going to be excited about change? What's their history of making business decisions? So understanding the lay of the land from that perspective, I think, is really important. And then having the right resources on your side who can speak to that type of personality, right? I mean, as salespeople, we like to think we're chameleons and can talk to everybody. But transparently, if you sat me in a room with an IT systems engineer and had me talk, I'd be like, well, that all sounds really nice. Thank you for all of that information, and I'm going to come back to you. So, being able to build that rapport and bringing in those specialties and speaking their language, I think gets people excited, right? Like when they get to nerd out with another nerd, like, heck yeah. Like I love talk, like, you know, put three salespeople on a call. We're going to sit here and shoot the shit and have a great time and remember the call because we were with like-minded people. And so making sure that you're suiting your call for that as well. I also am big on multi-threading. It's something that I've really put into practice, I'd say, within the last year and a half of even if a person's not on the call, but I know they're going to be integral in the decision, I'm letting them know recaps of that meeting. So, you know, hey, Mr. CIO, I spoke with your team. This is what we covered. I hope to meet you down the line. If not, here's my cell phone number. Feel free to call me if anything ever comes up, right? So not making an ask to meet them as well, but keeping them in the loop. Ultimately, it's their budget. It's their time. It's their team. So there should be this clear line for them to say, okay, I feel comfortable reaching out to Megan and know my team's in good hands talking with her.
So you do follow-ups to C-level execs who aren't on the calls, but you know they'll be involved in it after each meeting to keep them updated.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. It's a great, easy way to multi-thread and let people know about projects.
Well, I mean, and how often are we in a deal? We think we have a champion who's just like solid as a rock. And then it gets to the ninth hour and all of a sudden it's like, well, our CFO pulled a project. And we've never had communication with the CFO. We've never spoken to them. We have absolutely no idea what's important to them. Why would they pull the project? And this way, at least I've been opening doors throughout the conversation and keeping them informed. That's not this total out of the blue message for me to be like, hey, you know, this happened. I'd love to actually be able to speak with you now, you know, and see where your head's at with this and if we can help combat what's going on.
Yeah, agreed. It smokes out the danger, doesn't it? It takes it like sort of kicks down the door of the things that you know are going to be potentially dangerous. Often, Megan, we hear there's like a period in the middle of the deal, which is like the dark period.
Yes.
Where you're like, shit, I've lost the deal. Or no one talks to you. And you're like, oh, fuck this up. Did that happen?
Yes. So I actually flew for my second time to go to the demonstration. I actually think I had 8 or 10 people in that demonstration. I had a full conference room. So ordered luncheon for the team. Everyone chatted a little bit. Then we dove into the, you know, guts of the boring technology that we all have to sell. Even when it is exciting, it's like nobody gets excited about expense reports. Let's be real. So walking through that, and I think there's always just this weird lull, right? Especially when there's a lot of people in a room, it's difficult for people to voice their opinions. So this is where, as a salesperson, you really have to pay attention to people during a meeting. Are they writing notes down? Is their expression changing? Is, you know, can you tell they're holding something back? This is where it's really important to be comfortable calling people out. And there was definitely moments where I was like, I can tell you have a question. What's going on there? You know, what's, I see all the wheels are moving. Talk to me about it. I don't feel like I necessarily got to all of those moving wheels in that conversation. And it kind of was a lull after that for a couple weeks. Like it's like demo's done. We do pricing, decisions are made within a week or two, right? It was like a ghost town, like crickets, like nothing was happening. I didn't hear anything, which was frustrating because they were so communicative up to that point and really excited about it. Felt like the demo went well. So that's where you kind of have to like go back to the drawing board and really evaluate what happened here. Like, what did I miss? Let's relook at all of these. But also I think we forget that companies have a lot going on. And 9 out of 10 times, their silence has nothing to do with us or nothing to do with the evaluation. It's a fire totally started burning and they have to put that out before they can even venture down this next road. So we take it personally as salespeople, like you're ignoring me and I thought we built this rapport and now like I'm not even hearing from you. So I think also putting your mind frame, your mindset in a different frame as to these people have lives as well, and these people have jobs outside of evaluating a T&E platform is really important in those moments.
It's true, isn't it?
Is there anything like looking back on the deal I was going to say there was two bits I really want to hit on. By the way, the part of where you're judging people's body language in a face-to-face meeting and asking questions based on that is like really, really fucking smart. Like if someone's writing loads of notes, you're like, oh, some things must be really resonating. Could you share that? And you want those live examples, like, oh, we do it like this, but, you know, and if someone's being a bit hesitant, you can just be like, try and bring them into the conversation. Hey, it looks like you've got a question.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
People are less likely to be rude to you, like, in person. True. I doubt they, like, would be.
Or, alternatively, you look fuming right now, Chris.
Yeah. Is there any reason why?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And then, Megan, what I was going to ask is, like, if this was the sticking point, is there anything, like, looking back in hindsight, you wish you did differently?
You know, I think now more so of getting direct feedback, it's kind of tough when you have that many people in a room, right? Because you're never really going to get super direct feedback. But I wish I would have individually followed up with each of them afterwards, right? Hey, it was great to meet you. You know, excited for your son's soccer game. Can't wait to hear about his results, right? Because we had talked about something personal. I just wanted to open the door privately for you to reach out to me with any questions or concerns, for you to be able to share in our forum in case you weren't able to, you know, because of course we're on a timeline too. So there's typically only like 15 minutes left for questions in a room of 10 people. That's a lot. So I think I missed that step for sure. And so moving forward, I think that's absolutely something that you just need to do, is open the door privately for people to speak to you.
Mm. I think there's two things that you could say there. I think it is right to do the full group email. I think that is right, and just hit the general points. But I think there's definitely the bit to be said to be like sending them a personal email with something like a bit of insight or something that really resonated with them, and try and get them talking on a different channel, or even trying to do that on WhatsApp or like iMessage.
Yeah, I try and do it before the meeting as well. I try and individually email people an agenda before the meeting. It's just like one-to-one. This is what we're talking about as a group, but I want to hear from you individually. What is there anything you'd add? Often people will come back to you and be like, oh yeah, actually I care about some other shit. And they'll tell you that. Megan, you said something before we started recording about selling like the intangibles. You said that word a few times, and selling like the vision and like the future. I'm assuming an element of that is selling the roadmap, but also selling things that you can't necessarily demo. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah. And I think this is where it goes back to, again, that trust barrier and why that's so important. I think a lot of sales folks look past, you know, it's not just about getting the ink signed on the DocuSign, right? It's really about what is this relationship that we're building? Because not only do we represent ourselves and our own personal brand, but we do represent our company. And so you have to think about, I, Megan, I'm standing here today. They're purchasing Concur from me, but I'm not their post sale. I mean, I am for 30 days, but really we don't get overly involved as new business reps. That moves to another team. And so how can I prove to them who I am today is what, again, my company emulates. So the intangibles is showing them during it, right? Actions speak louder than words. I'm a firm believer in that in all phases of my life, but especially in business. You can't demo customer service. You can't demo super customized aspects of the tool that we have to sell them on. And the biggest thing is you can't demo an ROI. You can demo a hard dollar ROI, but you can't demo leakage. You can't demo how much hours is your team spending yielding these tickets from your end users, right? You can't demo time. There are certain things you can't demo that you just really have to get them bought into the pain. So by asking them, you know, the second and third level questions of, well, if I can bring 10 hours back to you a week, what would that mean for you? Okay, why is that important to you? What impact does that ultimately have on the business? And ultimately, how is that going to change your job satisfaction? Are you working 10 hours of overtime a month? Well, now you can go to your kids' soccer games and you can go to your kids' orchestra concerts, right? And not be sitting there hand keying expenses, pulling your hair out, yelling at your employees. So, you know, bringing it to real life for them.
God, if you found that and tied it back to that level of personal goal, I could just already imagine being in a position where you'd be like, well, you could save me 10 hours a week and then I could have more time to do that. Like, done.
Yeah. And I think that's what we really have to do, right? It's like, what is more important to you, sitting here focusing on this aspect of your business that can be automated, or focusing on this aspect of your business, which ultimately will put more money in your pocket, right? Would you rather be calling and negotiating terms with your vendors, or would you rather be hand keying invoices into a system? I'm sure you'd rather be negotiating terms with your vendors. So, you know, what is it that's important to the business and where is that time and value to them?
So when you come into the end of this deal cycle, I'm assuming you've already got templates of ROI calculators that you use based on like consolidation, time saved, efficiency gains, and so on. And then there's this intangibles element as well that you're going to build a little bit more of like nuance into it. But you've also got a big buying group at the moment, and this is a pretty big deal. Can you talk us through like the orchestration of that big, that meeting, that presentation, how you delivered it, how you kind of like pushed it forward to the point where you get to ask for the business?
Yeah, I actually typically have the ROI and financial conversations with the smaller group, because really that doesn't affect them. What affects them is actually what the tool is accomplishing for that company. So that's the biggest thing that's important to me, is the numbers will work out itself with finance, right? Like that's their bread and butter. That's what they love to do. But HR doesn't really care how much it costs. They care that now they don't have to, you know, push every single employee profile via ADP manually into a system. They can just use a connector, right? That's what they care about. IT doesn't necessarily care how much it costs. They care that they don't have to sit here and manually build an integration. So as long as I'm selling them on what is going to be saved for them and why that's important to them, the back end piece is where we start getting into negotiations, right? And actually talking the numbers with the people that make those decisions. So I typically only do scoping calls and demos with large groups, and then I'll slim it down to who actually cares about the numbers.
Yeah, I think that's really smart. I'm just thinking already of a use case I have where I was thinking about doing the business case to like the CRO and all the VPs of sales. And I'm actually thinking, why am I doing the business case to the VP of sales? I should just literally get the CRO on their own business case. This is what the impact is going to be. The other people, or try and, you know, multi-thread with the C levels. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think that's a great place to say, like, that's when you can have those private conversations with those VPs and say, you know, hey, what did you like? What did you, you know, what are you excited about? And putting that as a part of your business case, because then, you know, that's real valid information they're giving you to be able to say, you know, like I could have, on the deal, I said, hey, HR said X, Y, and Z. This is why it's important to them. This person said X, Y, and Z. This is why it's important to them. And this is why the numbers make sense, because your team is now getting on board with this. So I think, again, that's part of the intangible part of an ROI, that we have to get that buy-in from the other folks too.
And this is also why, and this is a good bit of advice for anyone who's like early on in their career and they're afraid about going too high up the chain too early. This is why it's important to go start with the end in mind, engage the economic buyer early, and then by all means get delegated to the buying group and spend all your time there for the next 80% of the deal, but remain in contact with the economic buyer so that by the time it gets to the end of the deal and you've done all of your due diligence and you've built out a group that's got a general consensus, you can take that message back to the EB and say, done all the work you asked us to do. Here's the general feedback. Here's the timelines. Here's the contract. This is what you asked for. Like, if you haven't done that at the start and you try and do it at the end, it's like, who the fuck are you and why are you knocking on my door? So it's like the best thing to do, even if you don't stay there and stay that high throughout the whole time, it helps you get back there towards the end.
Absolutely. Well, and I mean, I look at statistically, literally my deals, and I would say probably well over 75% of deals where I don't have senior executive buy-in or communication with don't close.
Exactly. Do you know what? There's deals which are not even as good deals, and the company aren't even that good a fit, and the need isn't that much. But if you have exec level buy-in, your deal is going to move forward. Even if, for example, you've got the perfect fit, the perfect customer, your product's amazing, their current provider is terrible, but you don't have exec buy-in, it's not as good of a deal. It never is.
Yeah, I'm actually working one of those right now, and it's frustrating to say the least, right? But it's like, well, who do I have to blame but myself, right? I believe my champion a little too hard, and now I'm kind of sitting in the mess I made for myself. So it also really, I think pressure testing your deal is really important, right? I mean, if they're saying, no, don't talk to my CFO, it's like, well, why? Like, if you're willing to spend this amount of time, like, and your CFO can't even know you're having this conversation, like that's to me a huge red flag. Like, why don't you revisit this when you're comfortable with your CFO knowing we're speaking? So
That's so good. Do you know what? Let's take it back to the original point that Megan said. And you could go like with the POC, I'm going to be emailing your CFO, keeping them up to date. And if they go, no, don't do that, that's a big red flag that you can then, oh, why? Do they not know about this? Like, you're not allowed to speak to people. Like, that's a red flag for me. Maybe I shouldn't give you any more of my time.
100%. Yeah.
And we need to be selfish. We have to be selfish with our time. I think as salespeople, we're taught to kind of be like the dog with the tail between our legs. And realistically, like, we get paid very well in our jobs. And so time is money, and you need to realize, and I think this is perfect advice for people who are just starting their careers, because I was exactly this person, right? Like, I'll talk to anybody, anything you say, I believe, like, you got it. And it's like, no, you have to be selfish with your time, because you're doing your clients a disservice who are actually in the evaluation phase by exhausting yourself in areas that don't deserve your attention. And then you're not able to fully deliver in areas that do deserve your attention. So I think being selfish is probably the number one piece of advice I give to new salespeople.
Amen. Amen. Well, talking of advice, we've got to wrap up there. We've got a couple of quick questions to round up with before we finish. First of all, what is your favorite sales memory?
You guys will like this because you're from England. My very first President's Club, I hit my rookie year at Concur. I hit it on my 30th birthday while I was in London with my two best friends having dinner. I was actually celebrating with champagne and lobster for my 30th birthday. And I got a FaceTime from my boss that I had just hit President's Club in America. So the whole like restaurant was like, I started obviously like sob crying because I was a rookie and it was super exciting and whatever. But everyone in the restaurant was like cheering, and they brought a bottle of champagne over, and it was really, really cool. And I felt so proud to be able to share that moment with my two best friends, but also just, you know, it's like this new milestone in your life, turning 30, and then you have this amazing milestone at your new career. So that by far is like my favorite memory I've had.
God, yeah. Great memory. Yeah, I think that's awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, yeah. Megan. Really appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're a real achiever. So thanks so much for all the information, all the insight.